Nervous. All right. Good evening, everyone. My name is Nathan Isaacs, and I am an alcoholic.
Nathan.
So some things never change. I still double fist, but coffee and yeah, that's kind of in the dad joke category. NAA. Coffee and water, though. So my sobriety date is August 16, 2017. I have a sponsor. I actually talked to her this morning. We'll get into that in a second. I have the honor and privilege of sponsoring other alcoholics. I have a home group. It's the Jaywalkers group. We meet Tuesdays for a closed big book speaker discussion meeting and Fridays for an hour and a half speaker meeting. We actually just celebrated our 28th anniversary and just this past Friday. And we had a wonderful gentleman from Annapolis, Maryland, come down and speak. And, you know, there was a second I just like paused and looked out and was just overwhelmed with the gratitude that I get to be a link in the chain of this thing, right? That it is not about me. A little bit about the Jaywalkers history. You know, we started this Friday meeting in 97. I can't do math, so subtract this 28 years. And, you know, our very first Tuesday night meeting, and it grew multiple rooms. I mean, I was only like a baby when Jaywalkers was started. You know, started a Tuesday meeting just because of the, you know, the attraction that carrying a solid message of depth and weight of the three legacies of Alcoholics Anonymous, right? As my sponsor says, if you build it, they will come. The first Tuesday meeting, though, was the night of September 11th. And, you know, and I had the privilege of writing up the script, the history, all that for the meeting. And it's not about like what a good job we did opening up the doors and being there. It's just it's the power of God that we are able to access through trying to be in the middle of the circle and triangle of our three legacies of unity, recovery, service, our steps, our traditions, and our concepts, without which none of us would be here, right? So I called my sponsor this morning. Told her I was coming up here, and I had a sponsee cancel a fifth step. We were going to do that today. You know, I was like, I got to do 10 a.m., 3. I got to probably hit the road around then. And, you know, I don't want to say I was mad or upset or anything. I mean, if you sponsor people, I mean, just the truth is, you know, most of us, for whatever reason, for reasons that I have yet to figure out, just cannot or will not. And it's heartbreaking. Just to see people just destroy their lives, come in with a little bit of momentum. And then, you know, they get a girlfriend, they get a job, whatever it might be. And one of the greatest promises in the big book is if we treat the spiritual, we will straighten out mentally and physically. And when I got here from the result of a DUI and other things, and a probation officer in the state of Virginia who I thought were being extremely unreasonable when they said I had a problem with alcohol. I thought they were the problem. How dare you? Alcohol is legal. I'm not doing hard drugs, which, you know, is true. That's illegal. That's a real problem. I work. I show up every day. Whether I'm sober or not is a big question mark. How dare you? You know, and the thing about the mind of this alcoholic is I have in my mind what an alcoholic is before I got to AA, right? And it's, you hear this a lot, right? It's the person who is under the bridge, trench coat, no pants, brown bag, steel reserve, you know, whatever. And that wasn't me. But, you know, I also, it's like, yeah, person with the DUI and doesn't stop drinking, that's an alcoholic, you know? And I was pretty committed that that would be enough for me to stop drinking. But lo and behold, I get a DUI and I keep drinking. So that it can't be alcoholism. It's got to be a, so we, you know, we lower the standards so fast, you know, and I just like drink right past those, right? And that's just the baffling nature of alcoholism. You know, the first, you know, time that I really remember trying to set rules and parameters around my drinking. You know, again, this, I mean, like this story alone qualifies me for AA membership. I was, I grew up and lived in Richmond my whole life. And, you know, my parents lived in the suburbs. I was a teenager and I was driving to the city. And I had a, again, I've only been drunk a handful of times. And I was like, you know, it's a bad idea to drink while driving. Notice I didn't say drink and drive. Drinking while driving is bad. Drinking and driving, there's some moral gray area to that. Third or fourth time drinking, I couldn't tell you the exact number. I had a Four Loko in my lap. And I made what I thought was a conscious, sane choice of my own making to never set a parameter, a rule, a guideline around how I drink because I hate to disappoint myself. And I knew intuitively, not even 2 months into drinking, that I could not choose to drink or not drink. I didn't have the words for that. I didn't know what was going on. So, anyways, the sponsee cancels on me. And thank God, I heard a speaker recently say, I can come up here and give a great talk, sound good, and whatever. But what if I had a CCTV footage of how I lived my day today for in front of the meeting, right? Today, I mean, and this is not the case every day, but today I'm like, you know what? I would be okay with that CCTV footage being shown today, right? I was a little agitated, got canceled on, kind of, changed up my whole plans. And so I paused, I prayed, meditated, called my sponsor. I don't always do that, because I'm stubborn. And there's always this balance as a sponsor that I try to strike, or I, sometimes struggle with of, when I got to AA and kind of surrendered to this process, my sponsor said, jump. And I said, how high? Right. I have never been able to find the right words, combination of anything to make a sponsee or anyone in AA do anything. That's not to say that I coddle or that we coddle people or, or any of that. But, I was like, okay, I'm going to give this guy a call and I'm going to remind him of the commitment that we were willing to go to any lengths. And he's not meeting up to that. I'm not saying that there's not a place and that wouldn't, and that conversation won't happen. But the truth is, no human power can relieve me of my alcoholism, nor can it relieve anyone else of their alcoholism. And, I can use AA as frothy emotional appeal in a sort of a way, right? And I know exactly where he is. Not working, he's got a job coming up. And, what was said is, I'm starting work tomorrow. I can't use the mental energy to do this before I start work. And it's like, again, it's like the backward, what I perceived was backwards in AA. It is only by doing this work here that I am able to go to work and to show up. It doesn't make sense, right? I get to AA with a DUI. I lost my job. I can't stop drinking. Jail time pending, fines out the wazoo. And I looked at that. I'm like, are you serious? Like, you've got to be kidding me. I have a medical condition, and you mean to tell me you people believe that, like, what, you can pray the drunk away? Like, that just doesn't make any sense to me, right? So that is to say, if you were new or suffering or struggling, there's no way that I can just like look at this and figure this out and intellectually execute the 12 steps effectively to solve my problem, which is myself. And it doesn't make sense. And I cannot define, understand from intellectual terms, Alcoholics Anonymous, the nature of God, any of that stuff, right? We were talking beforehand, my sponsor passed away, had a really ugly battle with cancer. And, God is everything or God is nothing. And those instances, those moments really challenge that, right? What's the purpose here? What's the meaning here? Why did God do this? And, I'm glad y'all read 29, because our job is to share our the way in which we establish this relationship with our Creator. And for me, someone gets, it reminds me of, and for those that have been around a while, you've heard this, the parable that's shared in AA of the horse, and the guy gets, finds the horse and God's blessing him and he's lucky. And then the next day his son breaks the leg and man, what bad luck, and God hates you, God's cursing you. And they do that back and forth. Like, I don't know or understand why on the material world, like outside of myself, things are happening and playing out the way that they are. And it's not my job to figure it out. For me, what God is everything means is the pursuit of God has to be my everything, to find the God in everything. So anyways, but what ended up happening is my mom called me and I would not have been able to take that call. And she goes to church and there's a person that she does some church activity with whose son just got arrested for drinking at, Virginia Tech. And, you know, she asked me if I could give this woman my number. And I was like, it'd be an absolute honor. I wouldn't have been able to take that call had that fourth step or fifth step been canceled, right? Got to call a bunch of people on the way up here. And, you know, so anyways, yeah, I'm from Richmond, Virginia. That's my tangent that I'll start. So that way, if I'm drunk the whole time, at least you got a little picture of what it's like. Now, I grew up in Richmond, Virginia, and it's so funny. I thought I had the absolute worst life, worst parents, worst upbringing ever in the existence of humanity until I did my first fourth step. You know, my problem, it's my parents, it was the religion that I grew up in. And again, I'm not saying there weren't mistakes made or unpleasant things, but like the insanity that you know, humans don't, you know, struggle, suffer, that bad things happen. You know, my sponsor Valerie, and this is a little bit inappropriate, I don't know the most appropriate way to say this, so I'm just going to quote her directly. You know, alcoholics want to experience life at a low level orgasm at all times. I want to feel good, to feel okay, to be immune from suffering, from mistakes, from pain, and I don't accept anything but that, right? And I don't know why I'm hardwired. I mean, I know why now, but that's always kind of just been ingrained in me. But I had parents who loved me, who gave me everything I needed, a lot of what I wanted. You know, I hear stories of kids, like I sponsored a guy whose mother taught him how to shoot up at 13 years old. And I'm, you know, coming into AA thinking my horrible monster family. And, you know, they took me to school every day. They loved me. They fed me. They clothed. I mean, all of the things that a good parent does. And I'm just, you know, in my cups, I'm just like, it's their fault. Right. And I could not, and I'm not knocking therapy or any of that, but like, my God, the thousands of dollars that I spent drinking the whole time and never honest about it, of just over analyzing and intellectualizing, you know, the nuances of my traumas and you know, all of that stuff. I could never get free, you know. I know today that they did the absolute best they could, right? And so I grew up in a, you know, very decent, very good home. But, you know, my earliest memories in life were just perpetual discontentedness, restlessness, and irritability. And I don't know why that is, why, you know, chicken or the egg, right? Long, long debate in AA. You know, was I born an alcoholic? Did I drink my way into it? Like, I don't know, nor do I really care about that stuff. You can kind of choose your own adventure with how you want to view that. I just know for me that I was just, and I hear this almost every time I go to a speaker meeting, just so suffering in my own skin, always looking around to the next thing, the, you know, around the corner, there will be relief. This thing will fix me. This thing will solve me. This will change me. I will be okay when, I will be okay if, dot, dot, dot. And I just suffered under the weight of that. And only finding brief bits of relief through various human powers. I'm sure no one in here can relate to this, but if there's something I enjoy in life, I get a little excessive with it. I'm sure no one in AA, other than myself, has an excessiveness problem. But I would find relief from that, right? I loved comic books. I would go hard into that. And, you know, I'd get one and I would need the next one. And then, you know, that one wasn't enough, almost kind of like our phenomenon of craving, right? You know, played basketball, and I never played a sport in my life. I was convinced to do it. Within 2 weeks, I joined three teams. Like anything I do it alcoholically, I do it to excess. And I love that stuff because it quieted the mind. That's the other thing. You know, the big book says that the problem of the alcoholic centers in the mind. And obviously, and you know, if I could meet Bill Wilson, I mean, there's a lot that I would ask him, but I would love to ask him, you know, some questions about, you know, because the big book, this wonderful book right here, you know, the longest bit of sobriety was what, 4 years, you know. Like there's two ways that I was kind of explained, you know, kind of that line, like, right, the way that I view alcohol, the insanity of my mind in relation to drinking, that is what fundamentally brings me back to a drink every single time. But I also think at a deeper spiritual level that like there is something just fundamentally off with how I see, feel, and perceive the world around me. And that in of itself is not alcoholism, right? There's a lot of people with spiritual maladies. I mean, anyone that goes to Al-Anon, they talk about the spiritual malady in the same way that we have, and they thoroughly believe that the 12 steps can free someone from this bondage of self. That the third step sort of describe, you know, not sort of, but does describe as the root of the alcoholic's troubles, right? So, chicken or the egg, I don't know, but I do know that I was just crawling out of my skin. I could not tell you what I did yesterday. Well, actually, I do know what I did yesterday, but only because there's a very interesting AA story there. But I couldn't tell you what I did 3 days ago, right? My first drunk, and again, one of those weird things, I had this obsessive nature with alcohol ever before I even experienced the effects produced. My explanation, maybe it's because, you know, alcoholism has always been there, but, you know, I grew up in an evangelical Southern Baptist household, and they do not drink. Like I mean, they are very much opposed to it. My great grandfather died of alcoholism. We were taught, you know, don't drink, all that. So you tell me not to do something, of course, like it's only just like putting a magnifying glass on it, and like it's like a tractor beam. It's like now I got to do it. I mean, it's crazy, you know. Don't jump off the roof of buildings. Now I've got to go jump off the roof of that building because you told me not to. Look, so I was like seven, and I love blueberries, and I had a friend's parent at a sleepover who had blueberry wine, and I hounded that woman for weeks to let me try it. And I had a little sip and it was disgusting. And that was like the end of my controlled drinking, was a 7-year-old tasting. And I think they thought, oh, he'll hate this. And like, you know, and I did, I didn't drink it. But anyways, yeah, I was like stealing beer before I'd ever even gotten drunk. And again, maybe it's because I looked at it like, oh, I'm a rebel. You know, I fancied myself an outsider. You know, my heroes in life, some people have noble heroes. My heroes were, you know, for the punk music fans out here, you know, the Johnny Rottens of the world. Love the Ramones, love like, you know, like that's what I aspired to be, right? You know, just completely degenerate. So, you know, I'm living this double life, right? Of like how I want to be, feel, or like how I want to be presented in this world, how I want to operate in the world. Versus like what I'm really doing, what I'm really living, what I'm really thinking. And that plus just constant self-centered fear, constant obsession with self. Life was unbearable. You know, I was in therapy as a, you know, before I ever even picked up a drink, wanting to die, talking about suicide, wanting just to not be here, just suffering so much. I didn't understand what a spiritual malady was. And I'm not saying that everyone who feels that way is just, you know, inherently suffering from a spiritual malady. But what I do know is the first night I ever drank, my friend brought over a bottle. It was my sister's friend. I didn't have a whole ton of friends in high school, but my sister had a friend come over, brought over a bottle of brandy and Kahlua. Great combination. Highly recommend. Again, I don't remember what I did 3 days ago, but I remember the color of the backpack, the color of the shirts the bottles were wrapped in. I remember the hoodie that I was wearing. I remember the weather of that. It was in a spring. Everything about that experience that evening is just will forever be permanently seared into my mind because it was one of my first ever spiritual experiences. Because what it did was solve my problem, which is self. What it did was fill the God-sized hole that I have. What it did was give me relief. What it did was quiet my mind, which is just chattering and always telling me a bad story. And I always believe it. You can tell me all day, Nathan, you're wonderful. I love you. You're great. You're enough. But what I hear is something so radically different from that. They tell that to everyone. They don't really mean that. You know, what do they mean? I look nice today. That means I look terrible every other day. You know, like, and I can't shut that off. And lack of power is my dilemma. And like I said, I got to make a bunch of AA phone calls on the way up. And that was one of the things we were talking about. I still can't manage that condition today. I still have to have a sponsor. I still have to continue to trust God, clean house, and help others, right? Doesn't matter how little the resentment is. I can't wish or will that stuff away. I don't have the power. So that night I blacked out. It was, you know, I drank way too much. I just took shot after shot after shot. I blacked out. You know, that's, you know, what happens to any, you know, 15-year-old that weighs 120 pounds. It takes just ungodly amounts of shots. But again, what it did for me was something fundamentally different than what it did for my sister, who is not an alcoholic. She had a good time. She enjoyed a buzz, but it solved my problem. And I didn't run and chase it. I grew up in a very kind of sheltered home. But it was, again, seared into my mind that this is the solution. This is the answer to life. And when I turned 18, I began drinking regularly. Like I said, third or fourth time drinking, I threw out the window metaphorically and literally all restrictions around drinking, because why restrict myself? I don't like disappointing myself. I don't like committing to things that I can't, I can't do. So I'm just never going to put a parameter or a rule around my drinking. I'm going to drink how I'm going to drink, and if you don't like it, then you're not relevant anymore. Bye. That was my attitude. One of the, again, early drinking days, like I had a sponsee call it the look of yikes that we get, like the things that we do when we are drunk or drinking, that look of like, oof, that leads to obviously the pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization. It's a Tuesday and I'm not a hardened alcoholic. I am just beginning to drink. And I bring for a group of four, two 24 packs, two 6 packs. And I'm concerned it's not enough. I'm already obsessing about supply and thinking about the next one and thinking about the next one. And what happens if someone drops one of those, or some freeloader wants one, or someone I'm trying to impress wants a beer? I got to give them some because, in order for me to get someone to like me, I've got to give you something. I got to do something for you. That's how life works. I'm having these people look at me like, what are you doing? It's a Tuesday. We're just like having a nice day at the beach. So, I drink, so I didn't have a grace period. Like any invisible line. Now, there's two ways of looking at the invisible line that we kind of talk about in AA. I did have the power, quote unquote, to stop because I did stop for a good enough reason, like the story of the retired businessman in the Big Book. But I didn't have a period of social control drinking. I don't know what that's like. And then if you do, that's okay. That doesn't make you any more or less alcoholic than anyone else. I just didn't have a period of controlled drinking. It was just, I was the entertainment for the night in my friend group. Another totally random, another thing in AA that I did not identify with. People talk about, lowering your companionship to match the level of your depravity. I did the opposite. My logic was, okay, when I drink, I am completely incapacitated. So I need to charm my way into people who will take care of me. So I only drank with non-alcoholics. I would give them my credit card, my debit card, my car keys, and say, use my car, buy whatever you want, get food, whatever. Your job is you got to take care of me and get me home at night. So, I didn't have the experience of like not having any friends when I got here, right? I was surrounded by people that I loved and who were telling me constantly, Nathan, we're worried about your drinking. But again, frothy emotional appeal does not work for me. So, I drank with people who could babysit me, basically, until that became completely like unattainable. I couldn't pull that off anymore. But I get into a relationship at 19, and alcoholics, other than obviously the way that we drink, we also suffer from a whole bunch or a whole host of other quirks or neuroses, if you will. One of those is very frequently we have great pickers. And I decided to start dating a person who had just kicked a really ugly heroin addiction. And things are bad when someone who is a week off heroin is warning you about your drinking. And I was deeply offended. How dare you? I've never done anything like that. I mean, I'm not underage, but I'm like, this is just alcohol. Like, how dare you? So, I'm 19, and again, this is totally irrelevant, but started dating a man, and I lost everyone. My family, very conservative, my upbringing. Again, I'm living this double life. In one single day, I lost all my friends. My family kind of threw me out. All that that did was make me a victim. I did not handle that gracefully. I was obnoxious. And I can see where I was wrong today, but oh my God, did I play the victim card with that one for a long time? The Big Book says that resentment is the number one offenders for alcoholics. And I never quite understood that, even years and years into AA, because I attributed resentment with anger. And I don't really get that for just whatever reason. Mine, like I internalize stuff, right? If someone makes me mad, then it's like, oh, I'm just the worst person in the world. And I'm, like I don't, I've never been in a fight. I don't really lash out. It's just not how that shows up for me. So, when I have to write inventory today, it's always almost fear, it's not really anger. I can get cut off in traffic and again, I know I'm in the minority here. I'm just waving, have a nice day. Like it just, Zen attitude. I don't know why I am that way. So I was like, how is anger my number one offender? My sponsor said, go look up the word and the origin of that word. It means to feel again. That is my number one offender, to feel things in situations over and over and over and over and over again. And drunk or sober, that is just poison for me. So what that situation did was just create this victimhood mentality, which is one of the most toxic and destructive things for alcoholics. It is such a hard thing to just to maintain that and recover. I just see it over and over again. So that's what happened, right? I became a victim. I, instantly moved in because what do two alcoholics bring on a first date? A U-Haul, right? And that's what I did. And I'm a victim now, and I have good reason to behave this way. And how dare anyone tell me about anything in my life? Dot dot dot. But again, my partner at that time was like, "Yeah, you're drinking. It's not attractive." So I stopped drinking for about a year. Right. Towards the end of my drinking, I couldn't do that, So I still had some, like I said, the story in the big book of the retired businessman was able to stop for a sufficient reason. And that's kind of what happened. When I got sober, that really puzzled me. I was like, how was I able to stop? And then, good sponsorship pointed that part in the book out, right? That, I had not lost complete power of choice. The thing with alcoholism, though, is I have a friend that describes it as like, the roots of it being what the third step describes as selfishness and self-centeredness. The primary symptom is the obsession and the compulsion to drink, but it can have other branches. So I became a kleptomaniac because if I'm not treating my alcoholism, if I'm not treating my spiritual malady, I got to find some form of relief. And I had it in a partner, and that was my higher power. And, shoplifting, but there is a fundamental difference. So I would go into a store with no intention of stealing. The thought would come on, the obsession would come on, and I would almost like in a blackout, go do it. I wasn't raised that way, wasn't taught to do that. I know right from wrong. And I would feel some level of guilt. I would also justify it by, these evil corporations, they're destroying America, they have it coming, et cetera. And I had my rules. I'm not gonna, mom and pop businesses are off limits, not going to take from individuals. I'll take your dry goods and your booze. But, this is the way we can justify and rationalize anything. And again, justification and rationalization, yes, that is a mentality that we have while drinking. But when we stop drinking, that just doesn't magically disappear. I can justify and rationalize anything, So eventually I get arrested. I pulled a Winona Ryder, and that I got caught shoplifting from Saks Fifth Avenue, and I'm banned for life. The interesting thing, and this is important for one reason, right? Like I said, gave me some form of relief, was a, was an addictive behavior. There was an obsessive and compulsive component to it. I put my hand on the stove. I got a consequence, never did it ever again. But with drinking, that is not what happens to someone like me. To arrest from drinking, hand on the stove. Well, we'll try the other hand. The other hand won't hurt, right? And I do that over and over again, arrest number three. I mean, I was talking to my mom about it this morning, and God, it was kind of gut-wrenching. She was recounting the story of my DUI. Like most, it's the statistic that we learn in ASAP, right? Most DUIs happen 5 miles from home or whatever the number is. I totaled my car. I just ran off the side of the road. And I mean, the truth is, and again, this is alcoholism for sure. I was pissed because I only blew a 0.16, and that's like nothing compared to how I normally drink. The truth is, I had a doctor give me a prescription for amphetamines, and I was abusing that to allow me to drink, and I had come off that. That's all. I'm not going to get into that because it's, I mean, what it did was allow me to drink and go to work and show up, and I used it to manage, try to manage my alcoholism and my drinking. But I had come down from that and spent all day drinking, and I took a little nap in the car just somewhere, maybe, and I was like, all right, I'm going to nap for a few hours and get in the car and go home. And so I'm coming down from amphetamines, and I've been drinking all day. Like, I mean, second I wake up, all day, and I fall asleep behind the wheel. And I call my mom; she's right down the street. I'm like, "Hey, a car ran me off the side of the road." And the thing with alcoholism is, like, I believe that lie. I mean, that's the power of alcoholism. She comes and gets me. And she's watching the cops come and arrest her son and fail a breathalyzer or fail a field sobriety. I refuse the breathalyzer, but fail a sobriety test. One of the most just horrifying moments of my alcoholism, when I got a lawyer to go through all that, we had to review the police arrest footage, and I have to watch it again. I'm like, oh my God. And then I watched them turn to my mom, and they didn't, I don't know how they said it, but they were like, what kind of mother are you? And I had to watch that stark raving sober in the office of my lawyer. I drank about it, you know, not a bottle of vodka big enough though. So back to my relationship in shoplifting, I'm a mess because, you know, when I stop drinking, I don't get better. Without a spiritual solution, I get worse. I get sicker. You know, the only thing that happens for me is I feel resentments more. I feel anger more. I feel fear more. I feel insecure more. I feel self more. That's what happens when an alcoholic of my type with what I have. That's what happens when I'm not drinking. So that relationship ends. My best friend gets out of his girlfriend breaks up with him too, and every crisis is an opportunity. And I had already been arrested twice by this point, once for the shoplifting, once from drinking. And so I don't have a license. And I'm like, sweet, I have someone that's willing to drive me around. So I have a chauffeur, which is great for an alcoholic of my type. And I become a daily drinker, right? And you know, I'm working two jobs, sometimes three. Hard work has never been something that I haven't, you know, done, right? And it's funny because, you know, my sponsor Valerie said, Nathan, I do not understand how you work the way that you did and maintain drinking. Professional. No, it, you know, it was a mess, and it's not sustainable, right? Because it came to the point, you know, I was in line for a good career, and it came to a point, like I reached a jumping off place where it's like I have to choose between drinking and employment. And I was offered promotion. I turned it down. And I told my, you know, my friends and family, because I didn't go to college. I mean, I went to community college for a little bit. I had to pay for it, but that got in the way of my drinking. So, I mean, I'm not an idiot. Pay for booze or pay to fail out of community college. Obviously, I'm just going to pay for booze money. Not a very difficult decision to make. But anyways, sorry, I lost my train of thought for a second. I was talking about booze money, of course. DUI. Well, we'll just continue. I start drinking. Every crisis is an opportunity. So, you know, I become a daily drinker. Very quickly, I'm working, and I quit this job. That's where I was. I quit this job, and I tell my family and friends who are like, "Okay, I have a nice car. You know, I'm building a life. I'm living a double life, though. No one knows how much I'm drinking." And I give them some excuse for how unethical this company is, how they exploit people. And here's the thing with alcoholism, all that stuff is true. But the real truth and the level of honesty that AA requires of me, yes, this job was due, and it was free, real estate kind of leasing company in Richmond. And they were doing some really horrible, ugly stuff. And that is true. And that's what I told people as to why I quit. But the real honest truth was, it is becoming completely impossible for me to drink the way that I want and need to drink and show up to work on time. And that was the truth, you know? That's what rigorous honesty means, not surface level, right? It is just, you know, deep down honesty. So I quit that job, and, you know, like a good alcoholic, I go into a kind of the restaurant, food adjacent industry, because it's great for alcoholics to work in kitchens. I'm working nights. It's great. I can sleep in. And you know, everything is mostly kind of fine. You know, I turned 21, and before I even turned 21, I'm already getting thrown out of establishments because these very unreasonable bar owners, you know, mind you, I'm in there underage illegally, but they're still the unreasonable ones. They don't like it if you're asleep just at any given random time, because the way that I drink, you know, it's really, I mean, yes, I do crazy and stupid stuff. But I just drink way too much, way too fast, and I'm unconscious. It's kind of what my drinking looks like, right? You know, I can go on with a good handful of stories of like, I never woke up in a different city. Like, I don't have any of those fun stories. It's more just like I came to and I have no idea what happened for the last 15-ish, how like 15 hours. I have no clue what happened. Like, that's kind of what my drinking looks like. You know, one of my favorites. So I had a friend that told me I could stay at her place anytime. And, you know, I took her up on that. However, breaking into her window in a blackout was not what she meant by that. And I got the wrong apartment. And again, thank God she didn't call the police. You know, I was, I guess, charming at some level. And I guess I'm not really a threat. But, you know, I had stuff like that happen before I even turned 21. So like a good alcoholic, what alcoholism is, that's the result of drinking too much. What alcoholism is stark raving sober. I decide that the problem is being out in the public. I need to go into my room and drink alone. And that's what alcoholism is. It is that thinking. That's what my problem is, right? Because if just drinking was my problem, then I would not need to be here tonight. I would just stop drinking and I would be just fine. So, you know, I get a DUI, like I said, and that kind of just accelerates my alcoholism. It gives me the direct hits needed to get and stay here, which is, you know, little consequences. It's like, whatever. You know, it doesn't really get the attention of alcoholics. And again, it is the heartbreaking nature of alcoholism. You know, unfortunately, I mean, so many of us die before we get there. It is just heartbreaking. I have no answer for why I'm still here. I was talking to my sponsor this morning, like I said, and she was like, Nathan, there was a group of 10 of us in treatment together. I'm the only one still sober. I don't know why that is. You know, we can speculate and talk about it all day. You know, I spoke in West Virginia last week with a couple of the do a little camping trip, and they go take this meeting out there. And we were just talking about, it was me and a guy, we got sober right around the same time. How's so-and-so doing? Not around. We were just going down the list. It's like, man, it's like us two. You know, it's just the heartbreaking nature of alcoholism, and, you know, it takes what it takes, I guess. So, you know, it accelerates my drinking and puts me in the position where I have enough direct hits to sober me up, which is the fear of jail was like number one for me. And I get to a place, basically what happens, the state of Virginia, very unreasonable people, they demand an interlock device in my car because they don't trust me to operate a motor vehicle without being drunk. And I thoroughly believe let me back up a little bit. I get out of jail, and I never really made a solemn oath to stop drinking. It's always been, I'll slow down. I'll cut back. It's our favorite alcohol. My two battle cries are, I'll cut back and you don't understand. Those are my battle cries. I get out of jail with the first time in my drinking career, the just the most sincere desire that a human being that I have ever had to not drink. I have that desire in jail. I pray. Maybe it was a selfish prayer. I don't know. It was a little bit selfish because I was trying to get into the good graces of the officers in jail. So when they would look at me, I would do this. So they would have pity on me. They would think I'm like a good Christian, and I would get off of the DUI. I mean, just crazy mentality. But what I learned from that is I don't jail very well, so I can't go back there. So I have this I get out of jail, and with the strongest desire I've ever had in my life to not drink again, you know, and again, this is like the cunning, baffling nature of alcoholism. You'd hook me up to a lie detector test, would have passed. Nathan wants to stay sober. Nathan wants to not drink. Nathan wants to, I mean, it was never again will I do this. It is baffling how, I don't know how many days, a couple days in, well, I just need to stay sober for the year. And then it was, I can drink beer because beer doesn't count. It's vodka. That's the problem. And then it's, you know, I'll have two, then, you know, off to the races. But I go to two meetings. It's a good alcoholic try, right? I'll go to two, you know. And look, you know, I used to obsess about what's the right way and the best way to do AA. My sponsor reminds me what it says in our prefaces. It is my job to share precisely what has happened to me, right? I can speculate all day about what you need to do. I mean, all of that, it's really a waste of mental energy. And I just need, you know, to talk to a sponsor, be sponsored, do these steps and just carry that message. So I go to two meetings and it's a bunch of people, you know, they're way older than me. Bunch of guys complaining about how dare their wives make them cut the grass, you know? And I was like, what? And they were just like, you know, don't they know I'm an alcoholic, you know, and use some colorful language about, you know, B words, right? You know, this B word wife made me cut the grass. And doesn't she know I'm an alcoholic? I'm 5 years sober. If you want what I have, keep coming back. I don't want that. In my mind, I'm like, I'm already paying a therapist a lot of money to complain. Why do I need to come here? But I was so desperate, I went back, right? Because again, there was somewhat of a desire to not drink. Now, had I gone to the greatest meeting in the world that was carrying like this message, would I have gotten and stayed sober? I don't know. I don't, you know, doesn't really matter. You know, I thought AA was like school. You had to go to the nearest one. I didn't know you could go to other meetings. And this was the closest meeting in my house. So I thought that was my assigned meeting. So I go back there, I bike. And, you know, like if you see someone out, I mean, I don't know if you get people that bike here. I mean, this is the suburbs of Richmond. If you see someone on a bike in the suburbs of Richmond, that's code for DUI. Right. So like a seasoned AA who's armed with the facts of their condition knows, let's go swarm that newcomer and just like, you know, and talk to them. Right. That's not what happened. You know, they just, again, proceeded to talk about how terrible their lives, their wives, their jobs were, and keep coming back. And I was like, I don't want that. And I drank. Right. So a year, I drank for about a year until I came into AA on August 16th of 2017. And basically, I had an interlock violation just because I couldn't stop drinking. And, you know, alcoholic, they call it alky math. I had a friend that was in medical school, and I calculated my weight, my drink of choice. Oh, I had this elaborate formula, and I sent it to her, and she's brilliant. And I said, hey, I need to drink, and I need to figure out when to cut it off, how much I can drink, how fast I can drink, in order to breathe a zero in the breathalyzer. And then when I have to go see the probation officer and pee in a cup, tell me when the enzymes will, and I mean, crazy. And then these messages are still on my phone. She responded with, why don't you try not drinking? And it's like, that's another language for an alcoholic of my type. You just don't understand. Drinking is not my problem. And I said that because those 2 weeks when I was sober after my DUI, like I said earlier, I got worse. I was filled and consumed with myself. And I don't know about you, but for this alcoholic, when I am suffering, and I say suffering, what I mean by that is like, look, my grandmother died at 9 months sober, right? And I met with the sponsee. We said the third step prayer. You know, I did all the things AA tells us to do. And I called a friend of mine. I was like, AA, this is BS. AA doesn't work. And he was like, why is that? I was like, because my grandmother died and I'm still sad. He was like, are you crazy? You're supposed to be sad. It's like, oh, like I mean, again, that such emotional immaturity, but like, that's what we're dealing with here. So I'm not talking about like grief, loss, rejection. Those are part of the human condition, the human experience. So when I say suffering, what I mean by that is like alcoholism, sober, sobriety, suffering. Every time I'm suffering in sobriety, 100% of the time, I am consumed thinking about myself every time. And I don't have the power to not do that. I have to have God's help. I can't get me off me. I can't get self off self, right? Thank God I understand today that I need to go, you know, live life with a spring-loaded hand and turn outwards and not go within myself, right? I need to go work with a drunk. I need to go call that sponsee back. I need to go do something for someone else. That is the only way, you know, along with the, you know, the quote unquote maintenance. Like, I know people don't like that term, but the growth steps we'll use. That's what I got to do to get out of me. So, I entered AA, right? Reluctantly. I did not have the honest desire to not drink. I desperately wanted to stay sober at that time. That's as good as it gets, right? You know, another thing that I hear in AA a lot is you have to be here for you. Here's the truth. That was not my experience. The truth is I went to meetings, honestly, because I was looking for a date. I wish that I could say it was for more noble or spiritual purposes, but the truth is there were attractive people and they were paying attention to me. It got me going to these really solid big book meetings though. You know, my sponsor used to say, Nathan, God uses what's at hand. A whole cow is used in the world of the spirit. You know, when a guy offered to sponsor me, my first sponsor, the only reason why I agreed was because I wanted him to give me attention because I was lonely. It wasn't out of a desire to trust God, clean house, and help others. How could I have known? You know, it says if you want what we have and are willing to go to any lengths, I don't know what y'all have until y'all sit down and tell me, right? So I did not get sober and do this stuff because I wanted to out of the bottom of my heart. I did it because I was in pain and I had some real direct threats, direct hits, as my sponsor used to talk about, which was I was going to go to jail if I drank again. And I think I just got done enough, right? Now, would I have stayed sober forever? Of course not. I know I would have drank again. So, I'm sober. I'm going to a lot of meetings. And I love my first sponsor to death. There was some worksheets, some Hazelden stuff, which is great. I was able to stay sober, you know? So I am not here to tell someone the best, the right, any of that stuff, right? I will leave that for other people. But what happened was, I love this group and I've listened to a lot of y'all's recordings. And I know a friend of this group, Tom F. Him and that group in Baltimore started this thing called Acts of Recovery. And it's a conference that really believes that the spirit of AA is God dependency through service to others. And I had a friend, because, I was doing a lot of fellowship, invite me to host or to help put on an Acts of Recovery in Richmond. And I go, and I have never been to a conference or anything. And I hear an individual describe how I feel and think when I am not drinking alcohol and describe alcoholism. The root of it is a spiritual malady, right? And describe just the nature of this condition in a way. Maybe there were people talking about it, but I heard it from him. And I got his number. I looked him straight in the shoelace and was like, "Hey, can you, I don't know what you're doing, but I like it, right?" And he really was the person who, I got honest and did my first thorough fourth step with, and really laid out the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous for me, gave me the keys to the kingdom. Another kind of, funny thing about like motives. And again, my sponsor is like, I'm not a big motives person. What I mean by that is like, for instance, the ego, the alcoholic ego, right? That thing is, that is a, there's a thirst there that cannot be quenched. So I'm not gonna lie, sometimes with service, there is the ego can get in and be like, look at what a good job I'm doing. The solution to that is to not help someone. Right. So my sponsor always says, like, Nathan, let's let God take care of all of that. You still need to show up and go help that person. Right. So the Keystone Group, which I'm sure some of y'all know and have been to, again, I was going to a lot of young people felt, I mean, I was going to good, decent meetings, but there was an individual and was wearing, for those that are fans of the band The Smiths, there was someone wearing a Smiths sweatshirt at a meeting. And I was like, had two conversations with this individual, and I was already planning our wedding, like a good alcoholic. And look, I didn't have a license. I was driving illegally. These aren't like good AA actions, but I picked this individual up. I had a restricted license. I could go to meetings, but I was not allowed to pick people up. But I was, give me an inch, I take a mile. I picked this individual up when we were going to go hang out. And I got really nervous. Man, what if a cop pulls me over? We need to go to a meeting. So just to, CYA a little bit. And I go to the Keystone Group. And that really was the first time that I had gone to a speaker meeting and heard someone describe alcoholism, right? And describe the 12 steps as they are outlined in this big book. And again, that changed my life. And all of these happened, just kind of all these things happened right around the same time. Synchronicity, all these things were just going on and happening. And that's to me the power of God. Like I said, there's so much I don't understand. I used to say all the time, all those nights driving in blackouts, I never killed myself or someone else. God was looking out for me. I used to say that all the time. Started sponsoring a guy, and he said, after telling my story, Nathan, my mom killed herself when I was a kid drunk driving. So God was looking out for you, but not her. It's like, ooh, how do I reconcile that? I don't have an answer for how God works. Was that dumb luck? Was that God? Don't know. What does it matter? Right. I mean, the truth is, like we share our experience, and if that's how someone chooses to view that, that's their business. That's okay. But for me, from my perspective, from my own point of view, my relationship with my creator, bad things happen. I don't view God. If a tree falls on my car, that was just my day to have a tree fall in my car. I don't think God has anything to do with that. There's the world of, the world of the spirit is the world of God, right? And that's what we have the ability to tap into and to access. So I do these 12 steps with this individual that I met at this conference. We went through them very quickly, and he absolutely insisted that it is required that when I am done, that I go do this with other people. And I just fell in love with Alcoholics Anonymous and carrying this message and this God dependency through service to others message that he was carrying to me. Maybe I went a little excessive, and he actually ended up drinking. And he warned me right before he went out, do not drink the newcomer like beer. What he meant by that was don't do the AA two-step, 1 in 12, 1 in 12, 1 in 12. I'm stubborn, so I had to do that. COVID hits, changes everything. You know, I can't meet with 5 sponsees in a day anymore. It's just COVID. It's just the whole kind of game changes. And, you know, it really forced me to my knees and forced me to really look at the, you know, my sponsor calls it the meat grinder of 4 through 9, right? And to really look at that stuff, because it is very easy to be very busy and drown in AA, which is exactly what I was doing, you know? And I know that because when I wasn't doing that, I was like, I want to die again. AA doesn't work. I fooled myself, right? And it's been a, I've had the most wonderful experiences of my life in AA. I've had the lowest, darkest lows of my life in AA. I wish I had more time to go into all the steps, but I've run out. All that I can say is, like, the definition of alcoholism that the big book gives us, right, is that when I start drinking alcohol, something happens and I get thirstier and I cannot turn that off. No matter what I do, how I drink, when I drink, where I drink, why I drink. My favorite, I was convinced that cheap vodka was my problem. So I started drinking this vodka, organic vodka called Grain, because it was always on sale at the ABC store. And I was convinced it's got to be the pesticides that are causing me all these troubles and my hangovers. That was my favorite. All that it did was give me a sense of entitlement. Like, I'm better than you because I'm drinking organic small batch. So I have that thing going on, right? You know, the other thing that the big book tells us is when I stop drinking, I can't stay stopped, right? And that is absolutely me. When I put a drink down, I cannot stop. You know, it's this double-edged sword. Like I said, you know, I suffer from this spiritual condition, this condition of self that is just crushing me. And inevitably what comes from that spiritual condition, that disconnect, is the thought, you know, what will make that go away? Go drink, you know? And I don't have the power to make that go away, to stop that, to solve that. Lack of power is fundamentally my dilemma. And thank God these steps have given me the power. I found an AA partner relapsed during the pandemic. I was able to stay sober. I watched my sponsor, I mean, again, this is morbid, pass away and die a gruesome death from cancer, was able to stay sober and suit up and show up and be there the day before she passed. Job rejection and so on and so forth. But I've also had the most wonderful experiences, and, you know, the gifts of sobriety are spiritual. You know, am I at, you know, materially, financially, economically, where I want to be at in life? No, right? But that's not the spiritual life. You know, I can go to bed with my head on the pillow and be at perfect peace and ease with the world around me, with everything being exactly as it's supposed to be, and be okay with that and not obsess about needing more of something to be okay. And that is a gift that is so priceless. And we are so lucky to be here and to have access to that, because my God, how many people on this planet could desperately use that aren't alcoholic? And that is a gift that comes from this power of God that I can access through the 12 steps. So thank you all so much for having me. That's not mine.